Thanks, Don. And thanks, Elwood, for that lovely presentation. Okay, now we have Vince Pilote, a wonderful colleague who has never failed to make me smile. Vince is librarian at the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. As a discographer, he has worked on Billie Holiday, Lionel Hampton, and the Commodore label. He has written several sets of CD liner notes for Music Masters, PolyGram, and GRP on Lionel Hampton, Bonnie Carter, Andy Kirk, Billie Holiday, and others. Let's welcome Vince Pilote.
Can I do that? Is that all right? All right. Hi. I thought since ARISC is being held in New York this year, that would be a nice idea to do something on a band that was pretty much based in New York, didn't do a lot of traveling or touring, and that was Charlie Johnson and his Paradise Orchestra. In the late 1920s and early 1930s, Fletcher Henderson and Duke Ellington led the premier big jazz bands in the New York area. But right under their heels was a great jazz organization led by a piano player named Charlie Johnson, playing at a Harlem nightclub owned by a guy named Ed Smalls, and naturally named it Smalls Paradise. Charles Wright Johnson was born on November 21st, 1891 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He came to New York in his early 20s and gigged with a number of bands as a trombonist, believe it or not. And then he moved to Atlantic City, switched to piano, and formed a band, and he did this around 1919. In October of 1925, Johnson came to New York to play at Smalls Paradise, and he pretty much led the resident band there until 1938, when he finally gave up full-time band leading. Now, stylistically, the Charlie Johnson Orchestra has been described as a cross between Fletcher Henderson's and Duke Ellington's. So if you're familiar with each style, you sort of get an idea just by me saying that, but of course the records will probably tell you better. The band was especially compared to Ellington's, and that was because both Ellington and Johnson played what you could call this sort of jungle music, for lack of a better term, that delighted and entertained the white clientele who frequented the Cotton Club, where Ellington held forth, and Smalls Paradise. There were always these crazy reviews going on with this strange music, and you know, people came up to listen to this. They thought it was exotic or something. Johnson's band also has been compared to Fletcher Henderson's band, and Benny Waters, who played reeds and wrote arrangements for Charlie Johnson, and is still active today at age 92, stated in a 1969 interview for Jazz Monthly that the Johnson band was more colorful than Henderson's. He also went on to say that we were one of the ones that first started the hats and the derbies and the wah-wahs and all those sounds. Fletcher's band was a lean, clean swing band. Ours was swinging, but with different little things that we did. The roster of musicians who played with Johnson was impressive and included people like trumpet ace Jabbo Smith, who was often compared to Louis Armstrong, has been compared to Louis Armstrong, and was actually one of his chief rivals in the 20s. In fact, there was even a record series that was instituted, I guess, by Brunswick or Vocalion, I'm not really sure at the moment, which was supposed to be like a rival to Armstrong's OK recordings. But Jabbo Smith was something of an erratic soloist, I thought, and you'll hear probably one of his better solos on a piece I'm gonna play, but he could play very fast and he could play very high, but I always felt his high notes lacked the conviction of Louis Armstrong's, and he just wasn't as solid a player, really, in my opinion, as Armstrong was, but that's me. Other people feel that he was just as good, so hear for yourself. Also, trombonist Jimmy Harrison was in Charlie Johnson's band, and Harrison has often been called sort of the father of the modern jazz trombone style. He sort of got it away from that tailgating style that the New Orleans players used and tried to play it more like a trumpet, and he had help in this respect. I mean, there were other players that did this as well. Miff Mole comes to mind, Jack Teagarden, but Jimmy Harrison is often forgotten and overlooked when they talk about that sort of thing. Sidney de Paris was also in Charlie Johnson's band, and excellent soloist, and you'll hear some of his work as well. The drummer for the Charlie Johnson band was a guy named George Stafford, and also very underrated, and you'll hear some of his work on these recordings as well. Another member of the Charlie Johnson band, at the time he was 21 years old, his name is Benny Carter, and he played alto saxophone. Pretty much that's all he was playing at that point, but he went on to become a trumpet player and pretty much a multi-instrumentalist. He also became one of the premier arrangers of the swing era. He went to Europe, he did work with the BBC Orchestra over there, and really he is today considered a legend, a true legend of jazz. In fact, he'll be 87 years old in August. He's still playing the saxophone, still sounds fantastic, and he'll be here next week, not here, but he'll be in New York playing one of the nightclubs, I think the Blue Note. I'm going to play you a clip of an oral history interview from 1992 that he did for the Smithsonian Institution. And on this, or in this little clip, he talks about his first attempts at writing arrangements for big band. And then after you hear this, I'll play you his first arrangement ever, a piece called Charleston is the Best Dance After All by Charlie Johnson's orchestra. Let's listen to the clip.
Let's see, why don't we go back to Charlie Johnson for a moment, since he sort of came in between all of this, and Small's Paradise. And this is a period where you make your first documented recordings in January of 1928 with Charlie Johnson. Now, we'll get to the earlier recording that, you know, you remember doing but has not been located yet.
You mean with some singer?
Yeah,
I can't remember that.
But in any case, the first real recording was 1928, mm-hmm. And on that occasion, two of the four tunes were your arrangements.
Oh, they were?
Yes.
Charleston is the Best Dance After All,
right.
And what else?
You Ain't the One, I think.
You Ain't the One, I don't remember that.
I think you have identified, you have claimed them, so.
Yeah, I guess.
But I think at this point we've talked about how you developed as a saxophonist to some extent. Mm-hmm. We should backtrack and figure out how you suddenly in 1928 were already an arranger, and the process by which you learned that craft. First of all, what made you decide that you wanted to arrange? Was there something you weren't hearing in the music that you felt you wanted to hear?
You mean something I can improve on? No, not at all. No, just I wish that I could just do what I was hearing and do what other people were doing, mm-hmm. Not feeling that I could of necessity do any better. I don't know. I'm not sure, but I think Archie Bleier had a lot to do with that. If the time is right, because we played a few of his arrangements, you know, the stock arrangements, and Arthur Lang and other people, I think. Ooh. Bob Herring, Paul Weyrich. What other names were that were doing stock arrangements? Jimmy Dale, Jack Mason, and I collected their stocks, you know, and I used to spread the parts out on the floor and study each one, and I start arranging like that without benefit of a score, you know, part by part, which I found out much later was really the hard way, but I didn't know any other way. And that was it, you know.
And this was during that period with Charlie Johnson, around 27, 26,
yes, I guess so, yes.
27,
uh-huh.
27, I guess.
Yeah, 27, yeah.
And then did you start bringing things in for the Johnson band to play? Or when was the first time you remember actually taking something in and having an orchestra play one of your arrangements?
I think the first thing I just did some things for the saxophone section, things with which I knew the rhythm section was already familiar, mm-hmm. you know. As my recollection goes, that's what I remember doing. And then following that, I guess somebody asked me for a score, and I said, what's that, you know? And they opened my eyes and ears and my head generally, and I, you know, learned to write a score.
Did you, in the way that you went to some teachers, you know, formally and informally, was there anyone other than studying the stock arrangers' work? I mean, you didn't talk to them personally.
No, right? I didn't know them.
Was there anyone that you turned to as far as arranging goes at that time for any kind of tips or?
No, I didn't, and I can't. I don't know why, because there were people I admired. I used to like Don Redmond's work that he did for Fletcher Henderson, and there was also an arranger that did a lot of things for Fletcher Henderson before Don Redmond. His name was Charlie Dixon, mm-hmm. and there certainly must have been others that I heard, but I guess I was. You know, too embarrassed at the time to ask anybody, you know. But of course, in hindsight being what it is, I should have just gone to a good teacher, gotten one.
Hindsight being what it is, it all worked out.
Well, to some extent.
Okay. The interviewer was Ed Berger, who was a Benny Carter discographer and biographer and good friend of mine and assistant director of the Institute of Jazz Studies, and he's always doing things with Benny. And Benny's one of the few people, or Ed's one of the few people that Benny Carter will actually open up to and answer questions now. He pretty much is questioned out. He doesn't really have anything else to say about those old days. He just wants to keep writing new pieces and doing new things, and he's not one to dwell on the past. In fact, when he heard this next arrangement at a conference that I was with, it was just funny watching his face as he's listening to this thing. I'm sure he's thinking he's so much better than that now, but it's like anything else you did when you were younger and you wish you could do over again. Anyway, we're gonna listen to that piece. It's the first thing he ever really did for Charlie Johnson's orchestra, or ever really did for anybody, arrangement-wise. It was composed by Charlie Johnson, and it features one of the things that Benny Carter became quite well known for, this precision, beautiful saxophone writing. There's a saxophone chorus on this, which is really nice. You should really take note of this. And it's played very well by this band, which is unusual in that this band generally tend to be a little ragged in their execution of pieces, but they do this one quite well. The soloists are Jabbo Smith on trumpet, Benny Carter has a brief little bit on alto, and the trombone player is Charlie Irvis. This is recorded January 24th, 1928. Charleston is the best dance after all. Thank you. second take of that also that has, in my opinion, a better solo by Jabbo Smith than that one was. It's a lot wilder anyway. Jabbo didn't stay with the band long, unfortunately. He had some problems that like the drink, like the womanize, you know, he was one of those good time kind of guys. And Johnson eventually let him go. It was something of trouble, I guess. The next piece I'd like to play for you is something called The Boy in the Boat. And this was arranged by Benny Waters, I understand, and it has more of an Ellington-ish flavor to it. It features Jimmy Harrison on trombone, and he also does some of the vocal exhortations. Sidney DeParis is on trumpet doing the plunger work, and that's very Ellington-ish, really, when you hear some of that. The clarinet is by Ben Whittet, and the drums of George Stafford are also quite prominent on this recording. This was recorded September 19th, 1928. This is take two, originally issued on Victor 21712 for all you discographers out there. And this is called The Boy in the Boat.
Yes, sir.
You can almost see a production number going on behind that music, people swaying and stuff. Anyway, that was The Boy in the Boat. From that same session, Charlie Johnson did another tune called Walk That Thing, which is a bit more of a straight-ahead swinger. It features the tenor sax of Benny Waters, and really, it's a nice tenor saxophone solo for this time period, 1928. I can only imagine maybe two other tenor saxophone players playing anything equally as good, and I would say that would be Coleman Hawkins with Fletcher Henderson, and maybe Prince Robinson with McKinney's Cotton Pickers. But Benny Waters turns in a nice one here. He does this thing after Charlie Johnson's piano intro. Now, I believe the trumpet work is by a guy named Leonard Davis. If I'm wrong on that, I'm sorry, but I think it really is Leonard Davis and not De Paris. The trombone solo is Jimmy Harrison, of course. Ben Whitted is on clarinet, and you get to hear like little breaks at the end by Cyrus St. Clair on tuba. Banjo player Bobby Johnson gets to do a few breaks, and George Stafford has a few breaks at the end on drums also. This performance is take three, first issued on Bluebird B10248. This is Walk That Thing. Piece, that ending especially, it's threatening to deteriorate into total chaos, but it never does. It holds together all the way through, and it's just great to hear that. A real shouting band there. Charlie Johnson died on December 13, 1959. His band unfortunately never achieved the fame of Ellington's or Henderson's. The fact that Johnson wasn't much of a businessman probably has something to do with his lack of success. He was a gambler, known to take a few drinks now and then also. There was some stories about how he would pay his band their weekly salary twice, which was nice for the band. so you don't stay in business long, you're doing stuff like that, I guess. Also, the band only recorded about 25 titles between 1925 and 1929, of which only a dozen were issued at the time. A lot of these were found, later and issued later. Dick Spotswood and I were discussing Charlie Johnson earlier this week, and while I don't remember his exact quote, I agreed with him when he said that the Johnson Band, unlike Ellington or Henderson, didn't mess around. They went right for the listener's gut. Yes, sir. Thank you.
We're keeping Vince here. Okay. This is what's going to happen. Let's have two or three questions for Vince. And in the meantime, let me invite Julian Morton Moses on up to the platform, and Michael Sherman and Mr. Bruno. And so we'll have this change of setup here. And Vince, go ahead, take the mic.
Okay. Lenny. How you doing, Lenny?
I'd like to add a few, higher pal, I've been down there. I'd like to add a few things with the courses at the Institute of Jazz Studies, mm-hmm. Yes, Dan Morgenstern, about Charlie Johnson's very first recordings, which I believe to be some of the most significant recordings ever made. It was behind Mary Stafford, who was the sister of George Stafford, Atlantic City days, And this was during the rage that went on after Mamie Smith hit with the Crazy Blues. And what do you think Mary Stafford's first thing for Columbia was? I believe the first, straight Afro-American woman blues singer on Columbia with Crazy Blues.
All right.
And that's in Columbia, or Dan can tell you all about it, too.
Okay.
And the other matter, you mentioned 1925. I guess you're referring to the Emerson recordings.
Right.
These are all extraordinarily rare and tremendous collector's items. I believe I have some in my own collection. So, but the significance of the 1921 recording is something. Because he was the one that gave me all the information on the personnel and so forth. And I submitted it to the discographies. And it's something. I met him a number of times at the Central Plaza, backstage there with Willie Lyon Smith and all the rest, and he gave me some good information. And then I saw him with a band at a Midtown club with the Red Onion Jazz with a ragtime. I know they had a washboard in there. He's still around, one of my subscribers.
Should have had you up here, Lenny. Any more questions? No more questions. Okay. Well, look, let me take this time.
For your, for your own future reference.
Right.
There's a couple of essentially Charlie Johnson records that were done without the complete band. Members of the band under Benny Morton's name in 1934. That wonderful Gold Digger song.
Oh, we're
Taylor
okay.
Taylor made and,
right.
all of those.
You're right.
Those are part of that corpus.
Right.
Wonderful part of these.
Great. Well, there are no more questions. Let me just say that if you haven't already heard, the Institute of Jazz Studies is moving. It's no longer going to be located in Bradley Hall, for those of you who are familiar with its old headquarters. We're moving this week, in fact. We should be doing this for most of the summer. We will be located from here on in Dana Library on the Rutgers Newark campus on the fourth floor. If you have any questions or any requests for information or anything like that, please don't call until sometime in mid-September, and we might be able to answer your question or help you out then. Pass this around, please. Everything is out of there. It's going. Right, it's all going to be moved. Right. Yes, Harold. Well, technically, all the stuff will be over there by the end of this month, hopefully. And then we're gonna need time to put it all back on the shelves and distribute everything around. So, yeah, I would say September is a good guess.
It would be accessible.
Well, for you, Harold, maybe August. If you, you know, talk to me, call me personally.